Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, we take a look at another historic preservation success story driven by residents determined to protect a property in Brandywine 100.
Residents don't win all the time, but they've got a far better chance of succeeding, especially in historic preservation, if they stand together. And that's certainly what happened on this occasion.
Contributor Larry Nagengast details the story of the Weldon House. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have a new arts playlist previewing an exhibition featuring the work of an incarcerated artist. And we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last week, contributor Larry Nagengast highlighted a historic preservation victory in Newcastle County, the Jester Farmhouse, while highlighting some of the issues keeping the state, and specifically Newcastle County, from seeing more success stories like that. But there are other success stories, and this week Larry looks at another one, the Weldon House in Penny Hill. His story on how it was saved and what its future holds is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to tell us more about it. So like we did with the Jester Farmhouse last week, let's start with a little bit of history of the Weldon House and its significance.
Well, the Weldon name is a familiar one in the history of Brandywine 100 north of Wilmington, and members of the Weldon family lived in this house on Philadelphia Pike at the top of Penny Hill for more than a century, from before 1800 until 1901. The Weldons were prominent not only for their longevity, but also as influential citizens and as farmers. It's not clear how large the farm was in the 1780s when members of the family first began living there, but it had grown to 102 acres by 1880, extending eastward nearly to the Delaware River. Now, as the home passed from generation to generation, family members added to the structure, taking into account not only changing uses for the house, but also the family size. William Weldon, who acquired the house from his father in 1854, and his wife had 9 children. So you can see the need for some additions right there.
And the battle to preserve this building has been a long-running one. Unlike some other properties that just kind of sit and go through what we call decline by neglect, this one nearly disappeared initially to redevelopment, correct?
Yes, that's correct. This house went through several owners in the second half of the 20th century, and in that period, its condition gradually deteriorated. Now, the woman who owned the house in the late 90s died, and her daughter, who inherited it, decided to sell. At that point, the owners of the 7-Eleven company were interested. They wanted to tear the house down and put up a convenience store with a gas station. Nearby residents fought the plan, and they created a group called the Friends of Penny Hill. They started contacting state and county lawmakers. Besides wanting to preserve the building, they also feared the potential traffic mess at a 5-way intersection that has 2 narrow streets on the east side of Philadelphia Pike. Well, anyhow, when all of this was said and done in 2003, the residents had won, at least for then. The State Department of Transportation bought the house, and Newcastle County put a historic overlay on the site. And that overlay effectively prevented the building from being torn down or moved.
So what happened after that 7-Eleven plan stalled? It seems like the property, from what you've described in your story, just you kind of fell through the cracks a bit and got pretty bad, correct?
Well, yes, DelDOT didn't really have a plan for the property, and historic preservation certainly isn't DelDOT's strength. So they sold it to a group of developers who were actually financial planners, and they promised to restore the house and place an office there for their business. But the work became a little bit too complicated or too expensive for them, and then the Great Recession hit in 2008. Progress stalled, and the home became popular with vandals vandals and squatters, and the squatters included both humans and a pack of raccoons. Residents rallied again, and in 2017, Del Dot took the property back. In 2019, ownership was shifted to another state agency, the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs. So once again, for the second time, the Weldon House was saved and prevented from demolition.
So where do things stand now? What work is going to be done on this building?
Well, Historical and Cultural Affairs has been working with Bernardin, an architectural firm, on plans for exterior renovations. And those plans were recently approved by Newcastle County's Historic Review Board. There's a little bit more than $1.3 million available for the project, interior and exterior, thanks largely to the efforts of State Representative Deborah Heffernan. The exterior work should start later this year and will bring the house back to what it looked like around 1890, with new materials, of course. Work on the interior is likely to be done next year, with the entire project hopefully finished by the end of 2022.
So how about the building's future? What purpose will it serve once that building restoration is done?
Well, the idea here is to turn it into a meeting space for community organizations. Historical and Cultural Affairs might set up a small office of its own there, but the key to making this work is to lease the house to a nonprofit organization that would serve as the master tenant. Putting an office there, keeping the building in good shape, and opening it up to civic associations and other nonprofits that might want to have meetings there. People that I talked to at the state level mentioned the names of several organizations that might be interested in serving as the lead tenant, but no firm decisions have been made. That's something that's going to get some discussion later on this year and perhaps into next year as the work proceeds on the interior portion of the restoration.
So are there any other Are there any examples of this type of setup working elsewhere in the state? Is this not a unique idea?
No, this really isn't a unique idea. In fact, the best example, according to the state's Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs, is just 4 miles up the road, up Philadelphia Pike in Claymont, at the Darley House. The Darley House is the former home of illustrator Felix Darley, and it's a place where author Charles Dickens once stayed for 2 weeks back in the, I guess it was the 1860s. And it was restored by the state about 15 years ago, and now it is managed by the Claymont Renaissance Development Corporation, which has its office there, and it makes the space available to civic associations and other local groups. Now, the state has somewhat similar lease arrangements with nonprofits at other sites in the state. They're not exactly on the order of the Darley House, but they do show that there can be collaborations between the state owning a property and entities that would manage it. Examples include the Belmont Hall Mansion in Smyrna and the Lightkeeper's House at the Fenwick Island Lighthouse. Both of these are operated by friends groups that are typically volunteer nonprofit operations. Also, the Delaware Nature Society runs the Abbott's Mill Nature Center in Milford. And a historical society looks after the Coots House, which is near the site outside Newark of the Revolutionary War Battle of Coots Bridge.
So did the state's involvement in the situation via Del Dot, the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs, and state lawmakers really make a difference here compared to other buildings we've discussed that were primarily dealt with at the county level and didn't have this kind of state attention?
Well, yes, the state's involvement definitely made a difference, but I'd also go back and retrospectively say there might very well have been a miscalculation here by the woman who tried to sell the property 20 years ago, or by the prospective buyers who wanted to put a gas station there. You know, perhaps they assumed that they would have little trouble getting the needed approvals to make those changes on this historic site. But then once the State Department of Transportation got involved and recognized, among other things, the potential problems with gasoline tankers having to move on to narrow Lure Avenue, not to mention the traffic management issues at a five-way intersection, Well, that would have pretty much doomed the proposal. Now, you know, I'm not suggesting that the county government, if it were the only one involved, wouldn't have stopped it. But the fact that lawmakers from both the county and the state levels were involved definitely made the difference here.
Larry, it feels like one of the key things that this story and some of the other ones that you've told tell us about protecting these buildings is that no matter what the state or the county do, that there's really no substitute for people or groups really advocating to save a property, that that may be the biggest factor in determining whether or not a building survives right now. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. Well, you know, as we've talked here today, I have only briefly mentioned the role of residents in preserving the resident, the Weldon House, not once, but twice in the last 20 years. Now, they banded together at the start. They created a nonprofit. They held bake sales. They raised money. They cleaned up the site, and they made contact with both their state and county lawmakers, and they never let up. They stayed in contact with these county and state officials week to week over the years, and made sure that everyone was in the loop and knowing what the status was with that property. And now when politicians see residents standing tall to preserve a property, they do tend to listen. You know, residents don't win all the time, but they've got a far better chance of succeeding, especially in historic preservation, if they stand together. And that's certainly what happened on this occasion.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on the Weldon House is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist, previewing an exhibition featuring the work of an incarcerated artist. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. There's a new exhibit coming to the Sold Firm Art Gallery in Wilmington. The Sold Firm Art Gallery was founded in 2018 by Nataki Oliver to exhibit emerging modern and contemporary artists and covers a diverse range of subjects such as sexuality, emotions, beauty, and current culture. The gallery's next exhibit features four pieces from 49-year-old Sakana Walls, a Philadelphia visual artist currently incarcerated at Vaughan Correctional Center in Smyrna for second-degree murder. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele speaks with Nataki Oliver and Sakana Walls to find out more about this exhibit entitled Storm.
Let's talk about the new exhibit that goes on display February 19th through April 24th. It's called Storm. Tell me about Storm.
So Storm is a solo exhibit that features artist Sakana Walls. Sakana is an incredible painter who used a limited amount of colors that was given to him while he's been incarcerated in a Delaware facility. He's been incarcerated in the Pennsylvania area too, but he was given limited resources to create artwork, and he used specific colors to get it done. This exhibit is basically his story on how he has been handling the process of being a creative behind bars and using the resources you have to get through, to pass through the time that you're living with.
Sakana, I know you are incarcerated at the James T. Vaughan Correctional Center facility. We have very limited time with you because you are incarcerated. Before we talk about Storm, give me your story. What's your story? Why are you behind bars?
My story is, before I was arrested, I used to work at a place called Iron Hill Brewery down on the riverfront. And I was working in the culinary art field, but I was also at that time battling with addiction. So my drug of choice was crack cocaine. And so for many years, for probably like 10 years prior to my arrest, I was dealing with addiction, you know, because I couldn't express certain things because, you know, expressing any type of emotion would be considered a sign of weakness from, you know, when I grew up as a child. So my incarceration stemmed from my addiction, and what happened was I owed a drug debt, and the person came to collect the debt. I didn't have the money, and I got charged with second-degree murder.
And how long have you been in prison, and what was your sentence?
I've been in prison since February of 2006. My sentence is 22 years.
Wow. All right. So you're involved in the prison arts program, in the Delaware Prison Arts Program. So let's talk about this new exhibit that you're now involved with at the Sold Firm. How did you get hooked up with Nataki Oliver?
Well, what happened was I spent some time away in the Pennsylvania prison because of overcrowding. And going to Pennsylvania was probably the best thing that could have happened to any of us that were sent there, because the resources that were given to us, you know, made it possible for a lot of us to have a better chance at, you know, coming back into society and succeeding. So when I went down to Pennsylvania, you know, I was immediately placed into the Philadelphia Mural Arts Project because I was painting in a cell. And the administration came to the cell. They saw the stuff that I was painting on the wall, and so they immediately placed me into the program. Pennsylvania prisons, they kind of like, you know, like come to you and allow you to do your time with what you're comfortable with, where here is like more restrictive. So while being there, I was able to become like a part of the community. I belong to several organizations such as Real Street Talk, the Man Up program. We also did a couple of art exhibits for the Public Defenders Association of in Philadelphia. And it was just amazing for me because while I was there, there was a lot of interest in my art. And the time that I spent here from, you know, I started painting in the Mural Arts Project probably like 2016, and I had never sold not one piece of art, you know, and I've submitted dozens, and I don't know where this art is. I have no idea. But we signed a contract, you know, stating that if it doesn't sell within a year, then it belongs to the Department of Correction. So I still never received any proceeds. So I didn't know that I was doing anything until I did the time in Pennsylvania at the Phoenix Correctional Facility.
All right, so let's talk about this latest exhibit that opens at the Sold Firm in a couple of weeks. It's called Storm. Where did this idea come from? Give us all the details about what we can expect to see when it goes on display.
Okay, Storm for me is dealing with reality. You know, as I said earlier, you know, like I was never able to like express myself, you know, outwardly, so I always held it inwardly. So the artwork that derived from my emotional state of mind is me on a canvas. You know, growing up, like I said, like we always, like when we succumb to peer pressure, we're always doing things to appease other people. So my artwork is just me, and right now I am experiencing extreme anxiety because I'm being judged for me, you know.
Certainly. Nataki, what has it been like working with Sakana to try to get this exhibit front and center?
It, you know, it's been some challenges. It has nothing to do with Sakana's ability and ability to do the best he can, or his excitement for the exhibit. It is basically just the limitations that we have around time and the limitations of him actually being out here with me doing, you know, curating the exhibit. So for the most part, because I've been curating for a while now, it was easy for me to get, you know, have him complete the things that needed to be done ahead of time. It just took a longer time for me to receive them and to make them accessible to the public. So what I've been doing, because he's not physically out here with me curating the project, I have been using social media as a way to show behind the scenes. So when Sakana has called, I will record parts of the conversation and give it to the public so they can be, you know, so they can understand and hear his voice and get a little piece of what he's saying. When we were did our video chat for the first time yesterday, I took a little piece of that and use that as behind the scenes, and then I went on another video and explained like what our first video chat was about. So I've been taking them like on a journey of who Sakana is. So when the exhibit actually happens, they will have more in their mind. But I'm getting a lot of questions like, you know, how did you contact Sakana? How did he reach you? like, you know, when is he coming out? And, you know, so it has been a lot of interest because this is something that has never been done in Delaware or Wilmington that I know of. So it's been challenging, but to be honest with you, I'm the type that will take on a challenge.
All right. To set the scene, we're talking to Nataki Oliver. Nataki owns the Sold Firm Gallery, the art gallery in Wilmington. We're also talking to Sakana Walls, 49-year-old painter from Philadelphia, who began his creative path in the culinary arts field. And later in life, Sakana served in the U.S. military. He's a father of two. Mm-hmm. He's a recovering addict who began drawing in 2010. And since his 2006 incarceration, stemming from second-degree murder, he's currently serving time at the JTVCC in Delaware. Sakana, what do you want people to know? You talked about dealing with reality and your anxiety in society today and because of your current environment in prison. What do you want outside artists, especially young people, to hear from you when they go to see Storm?
Well, I just basically want people to embrace their individuality. Paint what they feel. You know, don't look for anybody else to, like, solidify your existence. Do what makes you feel good. You know, a lot of times, like, you always try to, you know, get appeasement from other people. It's just be yourself. Be yourself. And because a lot of us, you know, even here, we'll paint pictures of things that we actually see, like real art. And for me, I just paint like what I feel. If I sit and I see a color, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to use that color. Like, I don't need nobody to say, no, that's a bad color, because people have done a lot with me. Like, no, why you do this? Why you do that? Just do what feels good to you, you know? And mm-hmm. So if I want to give any advice to somebody, it's just embrace your own identity, you know? Just, you know, stay focused.
Sakana, you're starting to carve your artist resume, if you will. I believe you had 3 more years left on your prison sentence. What do you plan to do? Do you plan on continuing your art when you get out?
Definitely. You know, like I said, I've always liked to do things for people. Like, you know, that's why I was in the culinary arts field for so long. I always like to create something and bring people together. And so, like, during this whole incarceration process, I had to do a do-over, reprogram myself and try to come up with something different. And my art is what I come up with. It's crazy because I kind of rebelled against art earlier in my incarceration. At one time, they had me classified as mentally ill, and they had me in the arts and craft class. And I told the lady, I said, this is jail. This is not arts and craft. So I kind of rebelled to get it early on. Then it's a kind of ironic that here I am. I'm doing it now.
Sakana, I don't want our time to run out. Your time is limited because you are incarcerated. I'm going to give you some final words before then I talk more with Nataki. Any final words regarding this exhibit, Storm, coming up on display at the Sold Firm?
Well, you know, like the pieces that are being displayed is all about hope, spirituality, understanding, consciousness. You know, I'm an individual who has experienced a great deal and who share those experiences so that other won't be faced with the same fate that I have. So when you go to the exhibit, I just want you to feel. Because right now, everybody's become so numb with the pandemic going on, with the government, with a whole bunch of stuff. And, like, even with me being incarcerated, you know, we try to relinquish expectations. So we try to just live life just the best way we can. Just feel. I just want people to feel for a while. That's it.
Very good words there, Sakana. Nataki, final words for you. Is Sakana the first incarcerated individual that you've worked with?
Yes.
And how has that left you feeling?
There's more work to be done. There's more work to be done. And I actually had this thought to work with an incarcerated artist probably about 3 years ago. I had this conversation with an individual here in Wilmington, and it just never manifested. So, and it's all about timing, and it's all about, you know, when the universe lines up, it's automatically going to happen.
You have 1 minute remaining.
So with me, being introduced to Sakana, it was something that was aligned at the moment because I had this conversation, you know, years ago. So I feel as though this was definitely meant to happen.
All right. I hear Sakana's time is just about up. I want to thank both of you. And Sakana, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate everything you've done.
Thank you. Nataki, you had a few things you wanted to add.
So I just wanted to make sure that people understood what happened once they get to the exhibit. So the initial name was Weathering the Storm, and it was based on Sakana going through the storm and weathering his experience in prison. And what people will come in contact with once they get in there, it will be Sakana being on a live video speaking about who he is and what this exhibit is going to be. So people will basically, they will get to see him for the first time and interact with him. And also there will be some interactive things as far as how people will hear him speaking about each piece. And I have brought in basically a sound engineer to record Sakana's voice, and he will be guiding the individuals, the visitors throughout the space. Because if we still have a little bit of restrictions, there is limited to 15 people per exhibit, but I have them timed out for the opening weekend. The first time is, I think we have like 2 tickets left, and then there's limited amount for the other 3. So there's 2 on Friday and then 2 showings on Saturday. His artwork is, 3 of the pieces will be on sale. 1 he will not let go. It's personal to him. And then he will also have prints as well if someone wants to purchase his artwork or purchase a print.
Is Storm Nataki broken up into different murals? Is that how you would describe it?
It is. No, he will actually have artwork there. We have managed to work with a framing company here, business. And because he has so much artwork I had to go through, I narrowed it down to specific ones that will really tell the story of what storm means, or weathering the storm means to him. So we're actually working with a framing business and a person that he has here in that's out here, a friend of his, has been actually working with me outside to make sure that his artwork gets framed. So there will actually be pieces of his artwork here.
How many pieces?
There will be 4 pieces, pretty large scale, nice size pieces that will be here.
Thanks to the Sold Firm Art Galleries, Nataki Oliver, artist Sakana Walls, and our Kelly Steele for joining us on Arts Playlist. Storm opens at the Sold Firm February 19th and runs through April 24th. And stay with us. The Green concludes next with the latest episode of the A Matter of Fact podcast from Delaware Humanities. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week we bring you the latest installment of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. The podcast delves into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of the Delaware Humanities mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. This season, the podcast more closely examines popular sources of news and information. And this episode is focused on print journalism and its move into the digital realm. That transition has been a struggle. Many outlets have faced difficulty finding a viable business model, an issue that's led to reductions in revenue and staff. And at the same time, they face competition from new online newspapers that are built specifically to operate in this new digital realm. What does this all mean to what news and information is available to people and how they consume it? To help us answer that, we are joined on the podcast by Dr. Pablo Boskowski, a communications professor at Northwestern University and founder and director of the Center for Latinx Digital Media. His work focuses on the dynamics of digital culture. Here is the latest episode of A Matter of Facts. So let's start with kind of the overall issue here, and that is that traditional print media has faced some difficulties in adapting to the digital age and specifically finding a business model. From your perspective, have things at all improved for those entities in recent years? Are they any closer to finding their legs online?
Traditional print newspapers have really struggled in recent years. There have been a number of closures across the nation, and in particular local newspapers. Now, having said that, some of the most powerful and well-known ones, such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, have, however, done quite well in their transition to digital, in particular their ability to generate a significant revenue from an ever-expanding subscriber base, and as a result of that, use those revenues to fund newsroom expansion and great coverage. So what you have is a situation that has, on the one hand, the smaller locally based outlets struggling, and then the handful of very successful national and in some cases international outlets doing well. So that is not surprising in the sense that digital media markets tend to be winner-take-all markets, that is, markets where one or a handful of players really dominate. We buy stuff on Amazon, we search stuff on Google, we communicate on social media on a number of properties owned by Facebook, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not surprising that we go get news on a handful of outlets. That's unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on where you sit, the evolution of traditional news media digitally in recent years.
Is there anything, you mentioned that divide between kind of the larger publications, the bigger houses, and local newspapers and local journalism. Is there anything that can be done to help those local outlets? Is there a way they can respond to maybe not have the same type of success as a New York Times or a Washington Post that have greater resources, but at least get themselves a little bit better situated in this new realm?
So there are a number of initiatives in play, and there are wonderful colleagues of mine in different universities across the country who have been studying this phenomenon. I, however, and this is my own perspective, I have not done my own empirical research on this topic in recent years, but my sense is that because of the nature of digital media markets and what my former colleague, now retired but wonderful scholar, James Webster called the marketplace of attention, given the evolution of the digital marketplace of attention, I think we're going to see more and more concentration of attention and a media industry where there will be a handful of extremely powerful and well-resourced outlets, and fewer of the smaller ones.
The other piece of this puzzle is the outlets that are kind of online first or online only. Have we gotten the sense yet of how they're faring? Theoretically, they'd be better suited to thrive in this environment because they were built for this environment, but some of those have also struggled. How viable are they, and can these outlets and traditional outlets and their digital offerings coexist?
So they can certainly coexist. Now, it is true that because they do not have legacy assets, delivery trucks or printing presses or you name it, they have a different sort of fixed costs, right? But it's less an issue of that and more an issue of brand recognition. Information products are experiential products. That is, if we go to a store to buy a pair of jeans, we try a number of pairs of jeans and we decide on the ones that we like the best. We buy them and we use them over time. Information products, once you try them, you use them. That is, once you read a story, it's over, right? So because of that, attention tends to gravitate towards well-known brands. Right. So the role of brands, which is very important across all commodified goods, is particularly important when it comes to information goods. And as a result of that, legacy news organizations actually might have, depending on the circumstances, a bit of an advantage because the brands are highly recognizable. So which is the reason why, if you think about the top 50 or so, you know, online or digital websites or digital news operations, you see a lot of the, you know, so-called legacy or traditional players, you know, having significant presence in that space. There have been a few, you know, successful ones, not just in the U.S., but also around the world in different languages. But we still see that people tend to gravitate towards better-known brands that are typically associated with traditional legacy brands.
So this kind of brings us into talking a little bit about audience news consumption in this digital environment. And you look at part of this, or this as part of your upcoming book, Abundance, on the experience of living in a world of information plenty. What do we know about audience consumption of news via traditional newspaper publications online, these newer online outlets, and compared to other media, radio, television, things like that?
Right. So, yes, in that book that Oxford University Press will be publishing in a few months, what I found is that more and more our consumption of news, not only digitally, but also in traditional media, tends to be of an ambient form. That is, instead of sitting down and opening the newspaper and having an entire sort of experience, you know, focus on reading the newspapers or sitting and turning on the TV and watching that, we tend to consume news in an ambient fashion. We listen to a podcast when we do something else. We put on the television newscast and we do, you know, laundry or cooking. And more importantly, we are out and about. We check social media, you know, when we have, you know, seconds of downtime. And that way, a story is posted, you know, we found the story that is posted by a friend or an acquaintance on a given platform, and that's how we learn about current affairs. So it is less about having our primary focus of attention being the news, but the news being something that we learn about in an incidental fashion while we're doing something else, as a byproduct of that other activity. And that's why more and more our consumption of news happens on social media. We do not go to a social media platform to learn about current affairs. That Twitter being the exception, but you know, Twitter is a fairly niche platform when we think about the array of platforms that people have at their disposal. We go on social media to socialize, to tell our stories and to find out what our acquaintances and friends and family members have been up to. And then when we're there, we stumble upon the news, and on occasion we might click on a story, but for the most part, we just get the information that is posted on somebody else's newsfeed.
I find it interesting because one of the ways you describe social media and kind of its impact is it's a labyrinth. And I'm curious, you know, listening to what you just had to say, what the implications of this way of kind of engaging with news and information has on people, and maybe more specifically, their ability to distinguish between credible news, which you would expect to get if you went directly to, you know, a newspaper or an online news source or listen to the radio, and what you're getting off a social media platform.
Correct. So what happens when we get news on social media is first and foremost that our, you know, diet, so to speak, is filtered not only through the media, which primarily produces the story, but secondarily through the contact on social media, like Facebook, who posts that story. Right? Unless we get that story directly from the social media account of a traditional media organization, if we either like that page before, etc. But most people really get their news on social media through their contacts. So what you have there is a two-level of filtering. You have the filtering by the media organization, which decides of all possible events in the world, which ones are going to be newsworthy, and then there is a framing of that. Right? I mean, we're going to tell the story in this way, but not in that other way. That's one first layer of filtering. Then you have to add to that the second layer of filtering that is the filtering of the person who selects. Of all the possible stories you know, your contact. You know, I'm going to, you know, post on that story. And sometimes they add their own perspective. So, you know, the first thing to notice is that there is these two levels of filter. Second is that, you know, when we, you know, watch television or when we read the news, what we have is news content, you know, a particular story within the context of other stories. On social media, we have a news story in the context of posts about, you know, trips, about pets, about anything in the world. So so the news is sort of decontextualized. A given story is decontextualized from the flow of news in general. And the attention is fairly fleeting. You know, most people, you know, scroll through their feed, and it's very common, for instance, that people, you know, are on social media during public transit, and whenever they get to their destination, they, you know, start walking. So it's not that they finish their consumption of news when the news story ends. They finish their consumption of social media, including bits of news that is part of that, when they have to do something else. So in that sense, the consumption of news has become secondary or derivative in our daily experience.
And I imagine that would be, and I would imagine that would be difficult for these news organizations that are producing this news, because, you know, they're producing something that they expect people to kind of take in total, and it sounds like what you're saying is maybe sometimes they're only kind of getting bits and pieces of it.
Correct. Absolutely. It's very difficult, and it's also very difficult because they are not getting the revenue either.
Right.
In the U.S., you know, two companies, Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, and Facebook, get more than, you know, two-thirds of digital display advertising dollars. Right? So they get the content essentially for free, if you think about it. So news companies are producing the content, but the social media platforms are getting the revenue. So it doesn't seem like a very fair proposition, but it is the way in which it has evolved.
I do want to ask you about something else that I found in looking over your book, Abundance, and that is one of the things you found was that with news consumption, the impact of the socioeconomic impact seemed to be greater than other types of information consumption, where age tended to be more of a factor. I'm curious, because a lot of times in the news business, you hear people talking about age a lot. Like, you need to meet this younger audience where they're at in the digital realm. You need to produce things like podcasts and use data visualization to reach this younger audience. Is age likely to become more of a factor, or do you think it will remain this way, where in terms of news, socioeconomic factors are going to trump age factors?
That's an excellent question. So what we know now is that if you think about three major sources of media, broadcast media, television, radio, then print media, newspapers and magazines, and then digital media in two forms, news websites and social media, what we see is that by far still the top source of news is broadcast news, in particular television. Okay. Now, the second most important source of news, digital news. So print is going, out, essentially. So the people are still consuming to a certain degree, but it's not a top contender anymore. Now, the main driver when it comes to broadcast news, you know, the main factor has to do with socioeconomic status. And that has been fairly stable for quite some time. The thing is that, so if you think about overall, and if that is the main source of news, therefore that means that socioeconomic status trumps age as of the main structural determinant of where people get their information about current events. However, the audience for broadcast news is not growing, but the audience for digital news is. So as we project to the extent that we can, right? Since you were alluding to that, one might think that over time, age will become, an even more important factor than what it is today, and might at some point trump socioeconomic status when it comes to determining whether, where people get their news. But, you know, futurology is not the strong suit of the social sciences, so I will not make any major predictions.
Understood. I do want to also ask you about something else that that comes up frequently now when people are accessing news content through these various news sites, and that is this idea of sponsored content. A lot of entities have turned to this to help bolster their business model, blurring the line between this paid content and actual news that's produced by journalists. And I'm curious what you feel are some of the implications of that for people who are trying to find reliable news.
Well, on the audience side, it complicates the issue of trust. Right. So we have to understand that we are living at a time in which trust in institutions is declining, and trust in the news institution has declined quite considerably globally. So the largest study of digital news consumption done by my friends and colleagues at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at the University of Oxford, the Digital News Report, documented that last year there was a significant drop globally of trust in the news that one consumes. Even in the country they measured, I believe it was 41 countries last year, even in the country where trust was the highest, which I believe was Japan, even in that case, level of trust went down. So in a climate in which the public is already sort of quite distrustful of the news, then organizations presenting content that, even though they are labeling as, okay, this is different, this is sponsored content, but that by itself, by its very present, sort of is suggesting that the organization is engaging in sort of quote-unquote objective news reporting and quote-unquote some form of public relations, I think it can sort of over time undermine the overall trust in that particular brand. So what you have there, in my opinion, is a tension between the need for short-term revenue versus the potentially negative consequences for the brand down the line. And going back to what I was discussing before, if brands are an incredibly important asset in digital media markets, then that is, to me, quite a risky proposition.
One of the other things I wanted to ask you a little about is the fact that the news outlets also really have to compete with other content and entertainment that people consume when you're talking about the digital realm, that they oftentimes, you know, stand side by side these other pieces of content with news on people's devices. And I'm curious, does that, you feel, play a role in what these news entities need to do? Is there a concern that clickbait holds a higher value because it feels more entertainment-like than complex and nuanced journalism that people can find maybe too heavy or too depressing?
Right. No, that's, I think, an absolutely critical point. Just to illustrate this with a very simple number. In the U.S., the average duration of a session on a news website, not the people who get a story through a social media feed, but somebody who goes on a website, the average duration of a session, not the click on one story, but the entire time of that visit, of a top 50 digital news website has been fairly steady over the years. And I believe the last measurement I saw was 144 seconds. That is 2 minutes and 24 seconds. That's on the one side. On the other side, Netflix tends to be fairly secretive about their numbers, but there was an article a few years ago in the New York Times, so I'm assuming it's well-sourced and credible because it's a wonderful news organization. So in that article, I remember, there were some figures about the consumption of Netflix shows, and the average time that was devoted the week of a release of a new season of a top thriller on Netflix, the median viewer was devoted 150 minutes a day of watching that. So you go essentially the season lasted 4 days for that person at that pace. For comedies, that's for thrillers, I believe. For comedies, it's 5 days. But if you juxtapose, put side by side 144 seconds for news versus 150 minutes for for serialized fiction, then you have a problem for the news, right? So to me, the issue is not so much the issue of clickbait. To me, the issue is that evidently binge watching is a huge driver of consumer behavior of entertainment. And it seems quite difficult for news organizations to generate that. There is a portion of the audience that spends a lot of time on the news. However, it's much smaller proportionally than the portion of the audience who spends significant amount of time on entertainment. So to me, that's the key. How can news organizations generate that level of attachment to news content that is manifested, that is expressed in the common practice of binge watching?
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengate, Sierra Fisher and Kyle Parks with Delaware Humanities, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.